I'm going to give you a deep dive on staying safe online. I also shared a list of talking points of like takeaway notes, and you can refer to that afterwards so you don't have to worry about jotting down notes as you do this. I also created a copy of this presentation using Google Notebook LM, which is basically a one-hour podcast that talks about everything I'm going to say, and it goes into a little bit more detail too. That was a podcast created by artificial intelligence that has the full content of everything that I'm going to say here. So there's a couple of ways of getting the same material should you need to drop out of this presentation. So our goal here is to share approaches, tools, and techniques that will help keep you and your family and loved ones safe online. Briefly, I'll just mention who I am and what my background is. Why would I have anything relevant to say about this topic? I've been programming software for 47 years. I've been working in artificial intelligence for about 30 years since grad school at UCLA. I've done about 10 years of development of video games, movie, and television software. And for about 20 years, I've applied artificial intelligence to anti-spam, anti-fraud, and cybersecurity cases. And I did this work at Google, now called Alphabet, and Facebook, now called Meta, as the director of engineering in those companies. And I've also worked as a chief technology officer at two companies that do cybersecurity work, Human Security, also called White Ops, and a company called Permion. So I've dedicated a good chunk of my career to protecting people from hazards online. So first of all, technology gives us these amazing superpowers. What we're doing right now is just phenomenal compared to what people could experience in past centuries. We're connected across the United States. We're connected across the world. We can meet virtually. We can travel the world, and distance and language and access to facts and knowledge are no longer hindrances. My family and I, we just came back from 2 weeks in Japan. And even though we can't speak a bit of Japanese, we could still just take photos of anything we saw and just ask, what is this thing? What is this crunchy thing that's on my salad? And it will tell us. This happens to be like a fried quinoa. even these really tiny details of life are just enhanced by having this powerful access to modern technology in the online world. Yeah, all of these things come with dangers, and those dangers come to us relentlessly through media. You know, we just listened to Cliff sharing all the good news of the gospel. Well, when you go onto the web, you get some bad news. Cybersecurity threats have been relentless. 2 months ago, when I first prepared this presentation and gave it to a different church, fresh in the news was the information that 16 billion passwords had been leaked. So, you know, an incredible threat to humanity, these kinds of cybersecurity threats. Just a couple of weeks ago, 2.5 billion Gmail accounts had information about their usernames and metadata got exposed on the web. And so Google's been reaching out and correcting that problem for weeks since then. And I'm picking on Google because I used to work there. Other companies, Apple and others, each have their own cybersecurity flaws and dangers and risks. And in the news just this last week, there's a phenomenon called the Salt Typhoon hack. It turns out that hackers in China have been spying on people making phone calls. They've been spying on activity inside telecommunication companies. 80 nations have been compromised. 600 companies have been spied upon, and millions of people. So these are just a rapid-fire example of massive global cybersecurity threats that can touch just about everyone. Even if you're not online, cybersecurity threats can still affect you in some ways. So some of what I will be sharing in this presentation will be alarming, but as we approach these things, I want to emphasize that there are tools and approaches and things that you can do to participate in the online world much more safely. And if you follow these best practices, again, it can help protect you and your family. One of the areas of bad news is, unfortunately, seniors bear the brunt, the biggest part of scam and fraud and abuse losses. The FBI has identified that there's been $16.6 billion of internet crime in the previous year, 2024. $16.6 billion. They've recorded 860,000 complaints. And these risks are increasing year over year at a phenomenal rate, 33% year over year. About half of the victims of tech support scams, where there are fake government or fake tech support sites, have been seniors. And seniors have been exposed to about 69% of the total losses of fraud and abuse. that can be about $86,000 on average from one of these scam cases. And if you lose $86,000 of your retirement, that can be a life-altering thing. Again, that's just an average loss. Some people can lose much more, most people much less. And seniors can also be more vulnerable per incident. On average, they'll lose about 30% more money from a fraud case than a young adult will. Okay, so I want to help you have some tools and some confidence and techniques to stay safer and avoid these risks that are all too common online. The topics that we're going to mention today are phishing and social engineering, identity theft and impersonation, malware and ransomware, malvertising and scams, and also emerging artificial intelligence threats. So first of all, these cyber scams are based on one foundational approach. That is the intent to deceive you and trick you and gain your confidence so that the scammer can exploit you in some way. So they're fundamentally based on tactics of deception. In phishing, what it is an attempt to trick you to reveal personal information, such as your password or confirmation codes, these four-digit PINs that you can enter, your account information, your account numbers, financial or personal details, social security number. And a lot of times these attackers come to you disguised as someone legitimate, as government or corporations or your friends and family, or as opportunities that get pushed to you. So the first thing to do, the first rule of the game, is to be skeptical and to realize the attackers are preying upon emotions. There's two basic human emotions that we all have. If we're spiritual, perhaps we have less of these, but everyone does have them. And those two emotions are greed and fear. So they come to you pitching something that seems attractive. They dangle a carrot out in front of you. Something that looks exciting. Something looks good. I give an example here of, your mobile number has won $750,000 in the sweepstakes. Well, I mean, that's too good to be true. But a lot of the scams will come to you more subtle, more delicate or precise, and they'll still be enticing or appealing. The other fundamental approach they use is fear. They come to you with a message that seems threatening or urgent, like if you don't respond immediately, some harm is going to be done to you or to someone you know or love. So scammers wield these carrots and sticks, but so often these things are just phantoms, they're mirages. They're intended to trigger either greed or panic or anxiety. So one of the fundamental things we need to do is to slow down, to not respond emotionally to anything that we see online, and verify independently. If something comes to you, don't click on an unsolicited link. Don't call an unsolicited phone number. Don't trust caller ID, because that can be spoofed. Someone can call you on the phone and it can seem to be a legitimate company. Instead, the tactic that best defends you in many cases is to not follow up on the message that came to you, but go directly to the official website of the government or of the company or of the person that you're dealing with. Go straight to the source. Don't click on links and don't go through intermediaries. I will talk about why you need to avoid clicking on links and so forth, unless you really verify them. And I'll talk about that in much more detail. But an important thing to do is to make sure that if you're going to interact with something online, that it is legitimately the party that you do want to interact with, and not something fake, a clone, a duplicate. An important thing you can do, a useful thing you can do, is bookmark the sites that are important to you, your banking sites, your commerce sites, things that are legitimate and that you use and rely on and that matters. If you're going to be interacting with something online, especially be careful of anything that involves an instant money transfer, a wire transfer, Zelle, or other kinds of ways of sending funds. Those are things that scammers target all the time, because that once you transfer funds through any of these online means, then boom, it's irretrievable. And typically there's no recourse. You can't really get the information or the money back. So in phishing attempts, what the fraudster is trying to do is to gain your confidence by appearing to be someone legitimate, someone having authority, someone in a guise that you might trust, and then trick you into interacting in a way that causes you to betray that personal information, to give your account information or logins or credit card information or anything else. So some of the hot kind of common scams that we're seeing are, of course, people impersonating the government, the IRS, the FTC, the Social Security Administration, Medicare. You could get these as emails or texts or messages. Or you'll get a notice that you missed jury duty, or the, you owe a fine to the police. There's an unpaid toll. Or you have an invoice that arrives, pay for this package. Or someone can contact you pretending to be an airline customer service representative, to be part of a delivery service. A package is on a way, on its way. Click here and get information about your package. People can also, scammers can approach you in more apparently benign ways. If you're seeking employment, perhaps they pretend to be a recruiter. And as a pretend recruiter, get into a conversation with you and start pulling out information about you. Phishing attempts will also come through photo sharing, document sharing, and similar mechanisms like that. Imposters will perhaps pretend to be celebrities, or they might pretend to be a person of reputation or of note in your community. For example, they could impersonate your pastor. This has happened with Mel. He's had spammers impersonate him and then try to exploit the church. So spammers are heartless and cold people. They will manipulate you emotionally. One of the common techniques is to present the appearance that there's a family emergency, or somebody that you know or love is in jail or injured or stranded in the airport and needing help. And they can play upon our fears and our desire to be of immediate help to those that we care about. These threats become even more serious when you realize that we've got a world of artificial intelligence where people's voices and appearances can be cloned. And I'll go into that in more detail shortly. You can also be manipulated by threats, extortion, a spammer threatening to reveal personal information or to dox you. Doxing is taking your personal information and pushing it out into the public so that you can be attacked or criticized. All of these things represent potential approaches. Offers that are too good to be true. Another thing that's really common now is messages saying your account has been compromised or you need to move your money to protect it. If anyone ever tells you that, it's almost certainly a scam, because legitimate companies, banks and so forth, never tell you you need to move your money to protect it. There's the all common virus detected message that pops up and says your computer's infected. Just shut out all those messages, escape from them, don't touch them. If a legitimate company ever comes to you and says you need to pay by using a gift card or cryptocurrency or a wire transfer, those are clear indications of scams. So be careful of any of those means. Now, fraudsters have gotten more sophisticated over time, and often what they will do now is not just come to you directly with a claim that they have an offer or a deal or a threat. Instead, they'll use one of the many existing sharing services that have a good amount of reputation. For example, there's Dropbox or Google Drive or spreadsheets and so forth. And they will share materials with you. These materials will come from a legitimate company, but if you click through, then they may bounce you to another site and ask you to log in again. They may run you through a CAPTCHA, which is one of these bot or not kinds of tests where you have to like solve a little puzzle. And what they'll do is they'll have this intermediary file redirect you to a page that will harvest your credentials. And they'll be able to then impersonate you on the service that you think you're logging into. You could think you're logging into Dropbox, but you actually just gave your Dropbox credentials to a spammer. In these cases, you need to be careful of files that are shared with you unsolicited. If somebody sends you something and you weren't expecting it, don't open it, don't click on it, don't trust it. The principle here is zero trust. If anything approaches you, it can be an attacker. It can be a fraudster. Instead, get direct confirmation from the sender. Call up Cliff and say, Cliff, I just got this Word document, and it seems like it came from you. Did you send it? And verify with a real human or you know that the document is legitimate before you start exploring it or trusting it. Now, this part right here is a little bit old school, but it's necessary to mention. A lot of people still run into trouble because they've got bad passwords. Don't use weak passwords. Everyone should know this by now, but people are tripped up constantly. A weak password like 123456 or admin or password, things like that are all too commonly guessed. They're too easy. A password can be bad because it's too short, or it could be bad because it's a high probability event like somebody just marching their fingers across the keyboard like QWERTY123 or things like that. Using a person's name or date, those are too easy for attackers to guess. especially if it's information that could be scraped about you from the web. If you've shared something on social media that's a personal detail, where have you lived? You know, what's a middle name? What's your mother's maiden name? All of these things that are personal details about you are actually way too hard for a fraudster who's running an automated campaign at a massive scale to guess. So a good password has three traits. It is unique, it is long, and it is complex. By unique, it's important that a password that you use for one site be used only for that site and not reused across multiple sites. It needs to be long because any password that's really short can be guessed by something that's just going brute force through and trying millions of passwords really rapidly. So a good password needs to be lengthy, and it needs to be complex in the sense that it needs to be truly random or unpredictable. And you can get this by having a whole stream of random numbers and letters and characters and uppercase and lowercase. Those are safe, but they're very hard to remember or to type. And we'll get into some options there. Another thing that is actually pretty safe to use is use a phrase that's a phrase of maybe like four or five words where the words are unpredictable. Those can make good passwords as well. Now, the most common problem that people are running to is with the reuse of passwords. If you reuse a password, the problem is many companies wind up getting hacked. And when they get hacked, their database of usernames and passwords gets exposed on the dark web. It gets published on these invisible websites that cyber criminals visit, and they share passwords and they sell them. And then once a password is one of these databases, then you're at risk of a credential stuffing attack. And that's an attack where automation tries to log in as many different users using all the many passwords that have ever been seen before. It just crunches through an incredibly large combination. But if your password has been exposed because it was leaked on one site, and you reuse that password somewhere else, it's like someone now has that key and they can open up another lock. They can get into another account. And it would be a shame if your a password you use for, say, YouTube is the same as your bank account. And because one got stolen, now your bank account gets raided. This is known as breach amplification. When one security breach occurs, if you've got shared credentials, the attackers will then expand and try to reuse them elsewhere. Another thing is if an attacker can get into one of your accounts, they can learn things about you, and then they can craft a targeted attack to go after you elsewhere. For example, if they can log into your Facebook account and then they can crawl around and see your friends and things like that, they can build a profile about you. And once you've been profiled, you're now easier to exploit with a targeted attack in the future. These kinds of abuse might seem difficult to pull off, but you have to realize that we're in an age of artificial intelligence. And a person can program an AI to conduct surveillance, investigation, profiling, and then generate a customized or personalized attack based on what's been pulled in and learned and known about you. So threats that used to be kind of far-fetched or things that were only happening in spy thrillers or whatever, things that intel agencies had to worry about in the past, they're becoming more commonplace threats that can affect all of us. So one of the things you can do to avoid the hassle of managing large, complex collections of passwords yourself is to use a password manager. There are many password managers, and they'll plug into a mobile browser. The major platforms offer them as well. And it'll keep track of passwords for you. It'll help you always choose a good password. It'll type it in for you so you don't have to memorize it. And you can avoid reusing passwords. But something that's also super important that you get from these tools is that it won't type in your password on the wrong site. So if you come to a phishing site that's a lookalike site that appears to be identical to a site that you use, but it's actually a fake site, a password manager is not going to paste in your password on that site because it knows that the URL doesn't match. Generally, these are good tools to use. One danger, though, is it creates a single point of failure because your password manager will have your master password, and you use that to access your whole vault of passwords. If that ever gets compromised, then that's a more serious problem than if you just had a single password compromised. Still, I think there are some good password management programs, and they do make a good option. Now, passwords are beginning to be replaced across a lot of the major digital services by 2FA or MFA. 2FA is two-factor authentication, and MFA is multi-factor authentication. The idea there is that in order to log in, a system uses more than one thing about you. So the most common two-factor authentication that people are used to using is SMS. That is, you log into a site, and then it also sends like a 4-digit code or 6-digit code to your phone, and then you look that code up in your phone and you enter that into the site. That's an example of SMS-based two-factor authentication. Unfortunately, that particular mechanism is no longer trustworthy for several reasons. First of all, there are occasionally malicious telecom companies. There are companies that stand up and they act like a phone company, and they begin to route SMS calls through the phone company. And the SMS, these texts, are not encrypted. And because SMS messages, these PIN codes, these texts, are not encrypted, somebody who stands as a man in the middle and runs one of these fake telecoms can harvest PINs and then reuse them. And if an attacker is able to use both your password and your PIN, they now can verify that they are you. They log into your account using those two methods simultaneously and start to exploit you. Another thing that can happen, though, is SIM card swapping or SIM hijacking. That is where an attacker calls up or contacts a phone company and says, hey, I lost my phone. I need to reactivate my phone, and my phone number is such and such. And so what they try to do is persuade the telephone company that this phone number legitimately belongs to them, and they will try to persuade them using information that's been stolen or harvested about you online. That's why it's called social engineering. And if they can persuade the telecom that they actually are the legitimate owners of your phone number, well, they get their SIM recoded so that they can receive your phone calls. Then they try to log in as you using your stolen credentials, and they verify themselves as you using this passcode from the hijacked phone number. So it's a two-step process, but you have to realize that when you're dealing with attackers and spammers, they are professionals, they're learning constantly, they have a lot of resources, and there's a lot of these predators out there. So even though these may be multi-step and complex attacks, they're becoming more common. So the FBI has recommended that people unwind and stop using SMS codes and migrate towards other better choices. What's coming into focus as the good new choice and many online services are adopting are passkeys. I'll describe them a little bit more in a moment, but there are other two-factor authentication options that are solid as well. If you get a PIN emailed to you, email is generally encrypted, and so it's not subject to the same man-in-the-middle attacks as SMS is. But at the same time, you should only use an emailed PIN if you are actively pursuing the transaction. You should never look at them unsolicited or give them out unsolicited. There are also authenticator apps that you can have on your cell phone, and the authenticator apps will be something that will give you a code that you can enter in. Google has one, Microsoft has one, Apple has one. They're a way of verifying that, yeah, I've actually got this phone in my hands. There are also physical security keys that you can plug into your computer, and normally you use those in corporate environments where your company vendor sets up these physical keys that actually plug in and prove that you've got the physical key. Those are all ways of using two-factor authentication or multi-factor authentication that are more secure than SMS. But passkeys are the thing that's beginning to come on board. And if you get the option to switch from passwords to passkeys, you should take it. They are more secure, and they're becoming the emerging default. A passkey is basically this cryptographic blob of numbers, this collection of keys that resides on your device, and it holds a secret about your device, and it can be used to prove that you are you, or at least that you have that device in hand. And a passkey can't be exfiltrated from you in the sense that it's not like a password that you type in and the password goes across the wire or can be snooped upon. The passkey is not stolen by phishing approaches. So it essentially is a good solid way of blocking out a lot of phishing attempts. So please do take advantage of the opportunity to migrate to passkeys as it gets offered to you. And normally the way you use a passkey is it basically says, okay, I want to log into this site. The site is going to request a verification based on your passkey, and you're also going to do some quick action like press your fingerprint to a detector, or it'll use your facial recognition, or it'll use a PIN code that you enter into your device. But it basically proves that you actually have the device in hand, and so that's much more secure. Somebody in another country can't spoof it. Okay, continue on. Don't share information about yourself that's sensitive online to an unknown party. a bank or a reliable, reputable company is never going to ask you to tell them your PIN or your security code or your online banking details. If they're a reputable company, they've already got that stuff, and they will never call you or email you and ask you for those things. Those codes are only meant for you to go directly to their website and enter yourself. So don't share codes, security codes, with anyone who approaches you. And also, if you share secure information, don't share over text or SMS, because those can be snooped upon. Okay, why do people do phishing? They do these phishing approaches for two reasons: to steal your identity or to implant malware. Those are the two biggest reasons. So identity theft and impersonation, it basically happens when somebody has acquired information about you, and they're now going to begin to do transactions in your name, using your accounts, either stealing your money or harming your reputation. Okay? In order to protect yourself from identity theft, you want to protect your personal data, anything that's sensitive that can be used to uniquely identify yourself. So be careful what you share online. If you post something on Facebook, sharing is forever, because once it's out there, you really can't delete it. Watch out for even old school attacks like shoulder surfing. If you log into an account in a public place, somebody could be looking over your shoulder and could snoop on that information. Shred sensitive documents. Again, this is old school, but you should protect in things that have your accounts and personal information on it. Another thing to be aware of, you may think you can write off these risks because you don't go online much, you don't use computers much. Well, somebody can still take information about you, and without you being involved at all, they can still create accounts in your name. And your identity or your reputation or that of your children or of deceased people, all these identities can be kind of like stolen or mashed up by cyber criminals. And so it can wind up damaging your reputation or your credit history, or it can come back to you in some way with somebody saying, hey, you did this transaction. Actually, you never did. It was somebody in Nigeria who did the transaction. So they just used your name or used some detail about you. Okay, so you need to keep your devices secure. We've mentioned already, use strong passwords, migrate from passwords to using passkeys, use two-factor authentication. If you have an Apple or an Android device, turn on its anti-theft features. So if the device is ever stolen, it can be shut down remotely or, you know, otherwise protected. Do regular security checks. Google Security, for example, has a checkup that you can run periodically, and it'll like look through your status and it'll say, do you have any insecure passwords? Is there something wrong? Are you exposed to risk? It's worth running these security checks monthly or every couple of months. Monitor and lock down your finances. So review your credit cards and your banking statements to see that nothing unexpected has popped up there, because that might be the first thing that you notice about some cyber fraud campaign that was conducted and victimized you. So keep track of your financial records. You can subscribe to annualcreditreport.com, as well as other services, to get free credit reports. And then if somebody starts doing something suspicious in your name, you can challenge it immediately. If you challenge potential fraud immediately, rather than like letting it run undetected for months, you have a much better chance of recovering and not being harmed by it. It's also a good idea to go to the three credit bureaus, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, and you can go to them online and put a freeze on your credit. By doing that, you block other people from creating new credit cards, but using your name. And it's pretty easy to use all those services. It's easy to unlock your accounts if you need to, so that you can then apply for a credit card, but under your control, not some scammer impersonating you. A big part of what I've been talking about is, you know, don't click on dangerous links. Don't use things that are untrusted, because if you wind up using one of these methods that's compromised, the attackers, the fraudsters, will attempt to install malware onto your system. And malware is just a term that means malicious software. It can be any kind of software that is doing something that's unwanted. And really, it's open-ended in terms of what malware could do. One particularly nasty form of malware is ransomware. And what ransomware will do is it will lock up your device or your accounts and encrypt your content so you can't read it or use it. It essentially steals whatever's on your device and holds it hostage, and demands that you have a payment. You make a payment to unlock your device. That's one form of malicious software, and there's many others. These are spread by you basically practicing some kind of unsafe digital transaction. It can be through infected attachments, malicious websites that you visit, things that are drive-by downloads. If you've got a browser that is not up to date, if your phone doesn't have the latest security patches, it could be vulnerable. And if your device is vulnerable and you go to a site that knows how to exploit it, you can be exploited without actually even doing anything. Just simply going to the site or clicking on the link means malware might be downloaded onto your machine and run. Once malware begins to run on your machine, it can act as a Trojan horse, which is to say it now has a foothold on your machine and it can reach out to a botmaster, a command and control server, and it can download more stuff. And that more stuff then basically creates escalating risks. And I'll describe that in just a minute. Unfortunately, attackers have gotten incredibly malicious and clever about what they do. It's possible for malware to even be pre-installed on a new device that you buy. So I used to work for a company called Human Security. And in the last year, they investigated a case that they called BadBot 2.0. And these were basically Android devices that were off-brand. They weren't produced by Google or a major manufacturer. They were a low-cost discount Android device. And if you bought one of these devices, it already had malware on it. And as soon as you got the device shipped to you through Amazon or whatever, it was an infection. It was controlled by organized crime and committing fraud from day one, from the day that you purchased the device. So when you're dealing with software or hardware, go through reputable vendors. Don't go for something cheap. Don't go for something that you think is a special deal. Go for quality. What happens if you are infected by malware? It can be bad. Potentially anything on your device might be stolen. That's the worst case scenario. I've actually seen that happen. When I was at Human Security, we were investigating a cyber criminal, and the cyber criminal had his own computer infected by malware, and that malware scooped up literally everything on his device and pushed it to the cloud. So you could see and download it, and you could see that he had hundreds of passwords, usernames and passwords, that he was using to commit fraud across a huge scale. He got all of his stuff completely exposed because the cyber criminal made the mistake of getting himself infected. So the worst case scenario is pretty dangerous. If you have a device that's infected with malware, sometimes it just shows up as the device being sluggish and connecting to the internet all the time. What is it doing if it's doing that? It's basically acting as a zombie being controlled by a botnet. And a botnet can be a collection of thousands or even millions of devices that are all controlled by a botmaster and all executing instructions. A lot of what they do is advertising fraud. They defraud the advertising ecosystem. And that's the exact job that I was working at Google, to fight to protect Google against botnets that were doing ad fraud. So that's a big use of botnets. Another thing they do is they mine cryptocurrency. They do computations to try to generate more Bitcoin or more cryptocurrency of some form or other. So they'll take over your device, and then your device will basically labor as a slave trying to make money for whoever is controlling the botnet or whoever is renting it out. Cybercrime is very sophisticated. Botnets are actually available as like a service. And so one cyber criminal will create a botnet and maintain it, and then they'll rent it out to different people to do different forms of fraud or different spam campaigns or different kinds of abuse. You don't want your device to turn into a tool of organized crime. So don't get infected. To protect yourself against this kind of thing, there's some fundamental things to do. Make sure that you are using current antivirus software. Keep it up to date. Keep your operating system up to date. If you get a notification that says it's time for you to update to the next version of Android OS or Mac OS or something like that, stay current, because each update will have patches that will fix security vulnerabilities that have been discovered in the recent months. It's good to turn on firewalls. Windows Defender is an example of one on Microsoft devices. What those do is they prevent outside attackers from talking to some of the ports on your machines. They can't reach out to your machine and start interrogating it. I've already mentioned two-factor authentication and passkeys. Make sure you use them. Again, be cautious of attachments or links. Anything that is sent to you could be the first step of a Trojan horse that's trying to infect your machine. Don't turn off browser security settings. Sometimes people will go to a website and the website will say, in order to do such and such, you have to turn off these settings. That's generally the prelude to an attack. And children who are trying to download games and play games represent a risk, because sometimes they may turn off defenses because they want to get this pirated game. So it's good to be kind of a digital minimalist, in the sense that the less you do, the less you download, the less you install, the safer you are. Install just the software that matters to you, something that's really going to be useful. Keep in mind that things like browser extensions that actually plug into your browser have more privileges than ordinary apps. and kind of keep an eye on what privileges you grant apps when they get installed. Don't just always click yes, 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 okay, okay, okay. If you're going to use a new app, what permissions is it asking for? And is it actually legitimate that I give it those permissions? Another thing that's good to do is turn off auto run and autoplay, so that if you plug in a USB drive or you plug something in your computer, you should never have that thing run automatically by itself. It should always be prompted, and you should only give it permissions if you know what it is. Control access to your physical machine. Don't let other people use it. Don't let someone untrusted. If you do banking on a machine, if you use it to access your retirement accounts, then don't let your kids play with it. Treat it as a precious resource to be defended. Okay. Make sure your screen has your machines have auto timeouts, so that they will shut down and lock up after a short period of non-use. And if you ever go to one of these sites where something pops up and says, "Oh, you've been infected by a virus," click on this to defend yourself. You don't want to trust or believe anything like that. You want to quit and exit out of that kind of unprompted message. And if it doesn't let you exit, then you can defend yourself by just shutting down your apps, shutting off the machine, rebooting, reconnecting later. Whatever you do, don't give in. Don't install or accept anything unwanted. Escape out of that situation. Okay, so you just mentioned that. Recovery and resilience. So it's not enough to just have clean digital hygiene and defend your machine. You also want to have backups of the most important things that you have and need and must keep. So critical financial records, anything that's important for a business, anything that is truly important to you. One of the general rules is you want 3 copies of it, and you want them in at least 2 different physical locations. So, for example, you can have 1 copy on your laptop, but then you should have another copy in the cloud, if there's a trusted cloud provider. Or have 1 copy in your house and then 1 copy in your relative's house, if they're trusted. So this idea of having multiple copies and backups, part of it is protection from disaster. If you lose a machine or your house burns down or whatever, you still don't want to lose your critical stuff. But it's also a cybersecurity protection, because if your machine gets locked up by ransomware, if you have to do a complete reset or restart, flush of machine, you still need copies of critical information somewhere else. So back up your data, back up what matters periodically. Be careful of what you connect to. One of the stories that I learned about not too long ago was that if you plug in your laptop or plug in your mobile phone, that very act itself could hack and compromise your device. Let me tell you how. There's this USB cable called the OMG Elite, and it is an example of something that started in the intelligence community and then has migrated to be used by fraudsters. It's basically a USB cable, and you could plug it in, perhaps if you're at an airport, and try to recharge your machine. But that cable itself has a tiny little computer inside it that will attack your computer and then try to install a Trojan that will then turn around and try to install something bigger and more malicious. So you can get hacked and have your machine taken over just because you went to an airport and you tried to charge it using somebody else's cable. Be careful what you put into your device, a USB or a cable. If it's not something you purchased from a reliable vendor, then you should assume that it is an attacker. Okay. And what is safe then is if you want to charge a machine, bring your own power cable. Don't trust to one that you find in an airport or an internet cafe or some other place like that. It could be an attack. Another thing is the man in the middle risk. We travel a lot, and our cell phones reach out and they connect to the nearest cell tower. Well, sometimes the cell towers will be malicious. They'll be controlled by governments. That's very, very common. But they could also be controlled by spammers who have a drive-by imitation cell tower, or they're using something that is imitating and acting as a man in the middle. These can be called MC catchers, stingrays, or dirt boxes. Those are some of the technologies. And what they do is your phone or your computer reaches out by Wi-Fi and thinks it's talking to the real thing, but it's actually talking to a proxy that stands as a middleman, a man in the middle. And if there is one of these devices snooping on what you're doing, there's several things they can do. They can redirect your DNS, your domain name, name server information, so that you think you're interacting with one site, but you're actually interacting with a fake clone of that site that can look identical, but it's not really the same thing. And that can be used as a way of capturing login credentials. One of these man-in-the-middle connections can also inject packets into the stream of information that you're sending and receiving. And so if you receive files, they could replace those files, or they could augment those files. So, for example, you could receive an app that you downloaded, but that app could be a malicious app that's been created as a wrapper around the real app that you wanted. And so when you run it, it looks like you ran the real app, but you actually ran the wrapper that is around the real app, and that wrapper added something extra. And that extra thing is malware, and it takes over your machine. So there are various defenses that you would use, that you should use to protect yourself against the man-in-the-middle attacks. Turn off the old protocols on your phone. 2G and 3G are not recommended. Switch to 4G or 5G on your phones, and choose settings where you turn off those old protocols. They're less safe. Prefer to use to send all of your messaging using encrypted apps, end-to-end encryption. Don't chat with people through SMS, because SMS can be spied on by a man in the middle. Use airplane mode when you're traveling. And if you do connect to third-party routers, don't have a feature that auto-connects to any router that it sees, that auto-connects to any Wi-Fi that you see. Make sure that you connect to the Wi-Fi that is the official one of some trusted party. Don't connect to some unknown Wi-Fi. So those are some of the ways of defending yourself against the man-in-the-middle attacks. Another thing, if you've been traveling around, visiting restaurants, out in public, you see more of these QR codes. And a QR code is something you can scan with your phone, and it basically turns into a URL. It turns into a pointer to a location of something on the internet. And it's a quick way of looking up information. For example, you can use it in a restaurant to read the menu and make an order. You can use it at gas pumps sometimes to pay, and so forth. People will put QR codes on packages, so you can scan the package and you can read about its history or whatever. But there are various ways that QR codes can be abused, and it's actually quite difficult to protect yourself against this abuse. So one of them I'm showing here on the screen is there's basically a paste-on QR code, a sticky QR code that somebody put over a real QR code. And this particular form of attack can happen in places that are public. What the spammer will do is they will create a QR code, and when you scan it and then click on it, instead of you going to the intended destination, it goes to a copycat of the intended destination. And then when you log in, and if you share your credentials, well, you just shared your login and your password with the wrong party. You shared it with an attacker because they stuck on this little sticky note. Another thing that can happen is you can receive packages in the physical mail. Somebody could physically mail you a box, and it could have a QR code on it. And if you scan that QR code, instead of actually taking you to the real UPS site or the real Amazon site or whatever, it'll take you to a lookalike clone. And if you don't realize that you're on the wrong site, then you could log in and share your credentials with a bad actor. Again, this is another case why it's good to upgrade to passkeys. It's good to use password protection, password management. And generally, consider that a QR code can be faked and it can be an attack. You don't want to get a side of malware with your burger. All right. Another category of threats is online abuse that we run into are counterfeit ads, counterfeit sites, websites that are basically malicious in their content and nature. And unfortunately, you could be searching for something legitimate. For example, in this case, PayPal help. I want to get information to help me solve the problem with PayPal. Well, the first thing that popped up in this particular case was an ad, and it's not the legitimate PayPal site. It's some attacker who's pretending to be PayPal. And if you are tricked to go to that wrong site and enter your PayPal credentials, well, your PayPal account is now compromised. So malicious advertising or malvertising is something to keep an eye out for. Make sure whenever you're trying to find the party that you want to transact with, that you're really going to the authoritative, real, true, actual site of that company, and you're not just clicking on an ad, because the ad could take you to a fake middleman. Malvertising will also take you to pages that will try to exploit your browser by malicious downloads, drive-by downloads. If you're not using a fully patched machine, if you've got an out-of-date version of the software, then there could be exploits that try to take advantage of the old software that you're using, and they could hack into your device and compromise it merely because you visited the wrong site. So again, you don't want to click on a link that takes you to an unexpected or undesired location. And of course, there's many other things you'll run into: ad stuff pages, scammy websites. You can identify some of these threats by basically seeing that they're not using security. They're not using HTTPS, or they could have low quality images, typos, misspellings. They could look like flawed versions of the actual real site. So be skeptical and be alert for anything that makes a site appear inauthentic. But at the same time, it's best to use, again, passkeys, password management, and automated protection so that you don't have to rely on your own personal judgment. Personal judgment can make errors. if you visit a website online, you should default to what we say is zero trust. You should not trust what you see. You should verify it first. Assume that any site that you visit could be an attacker. Why should I trust this site? Can I read reviews about it? Is it recommended by people I trust? Is it in widespread use? Or you can also investigate an online business and see that, oh, lots of people are actually complaining about them. They've got a security bad reputation. One thing that might be a good idea to protect yourself from just some of the noise and some of the garbage online is to use an ad blocker. And there are many different ad blockers. I mentioned a couple of them on this slide. uBlock Origin, AdGuard, OneBlocker, Ghostery, the Brave browser. Brave is a browser like the Chrome or a Safari browser, but it has a bunch of privacy and ad blocking features built in. So the fewer ads you get exposed to, the safer you are, basically. And I say that as a person who's worked in the internet advertising profession for decades. Ads can be a gateway to harm. Keep an eye out for the sites that you land on. They could be scams. They could be malicious. Do research before you buy. Be wary of anything that comes to you offering something unsolicited. If you are interacting with a person online, try to verify that they're the real person and not an AI clone or a bot or a masquerade. A lot of people get tricked by financial scams, by romance scams. One very, very common form of fraud is fake tech support calls or fake tech support emails or texts. People will reach out to you and try to say that they're going to help you solve a problem on your computer. Well, that's especially dangerous because if you're interacting with one of those parties, they're going to ask you to download and run some software or to give them remote control of your machine. And once you've done that, they're in control. They could do anything in principle. So if your machine needs maintenance, go directly to the manufacturer or the party that sold it, who's the legitimate service provider. Don't trust anything that's pushed out to you that's asking for special privileges or special access. Okay, getting to the part of this talk that's kind of new and emerging and novel, what's kind of breaking in the last couple of years, is the use of artificial intelligence to do very sophisticated, personalized, large-scale scams. And if you haven't been paying attention, AI is becoming incredibly good. People will slide it and say it has flaws and defects. Well, of course it does. But year over year, it just keeps progressing, and it's really quite startling what it can do sometimes. So artificial intelligence agents can carry out programs, and they can follow procedures, and they can do multi-step operations. And the scammers, the fraudsters, are technically sophisticated, and they use artificial intelligence very cleverly. We'll talk about a couple things that are new that are happening. Well, deepfakes have become almost everywhere now, whether you realize it or not. A deepfake is using a deep neural network, an artificial neural network, which is basically many layers of computation that have been trained on large amounts of data. And these deepfakes reproduce images or they reproduce audio. They basically clone the appearance of things or they generate things that don't exist. So we have Biden and Trump together and being friendly in this photo. Never happened, of course. One thing that's becoming increasingly common is the use of deepfakes to do audio voice cloning or vishing, vishing being a variant of the word phishing. The state of the art is that if the attacker can get about 10 or 15 seconds of clear audio, if they can just get this little sample of your voice, then they can make you appear to say anything. And that can be done. OpenAI has a voice engine that does it. Other companies do as well. Even if you don't have top-of-the-line state-of-the-art equipment or software, still, if you've got a couple minutes of somebody's voice, you can then clone that voice and make them say anything. So the mere fact that you hear your child talking to you on the phone doesn't mean it's your child, just to make it shocking or blunt. You need to be careful about things that come to you in digital media because more and more fraudsters are using it in illegitimate ways. For example, one of the things that's happened a number of times is attackers will use the cloned voice of an executive calling an employee at a company, and that executive, that president of the company, will be telling the employee, you need to do this right now. You need to transfer this money from here to here. And it will sound just like the executive. It'll sound like the authentic person. And companies have been literally defrauded out of tens of millions of dollars because the voice of somebody in authority was cloned in a very persuasive way. And this is not just something of science fiction that happens to the elites. This software that can do this stuff is more and more ubiquitous. And fraudsters are early adopters of technology. Okay. In terms of creating fake images, you can create a crude fake of a person from a single photo. You can create pretty persuasive stuff if you just have a couple minutes of video. And then professionals can make a person fully realistic, fully persuasive. It's unsafe to rely on your own judgment sometimes because some of these clones become so close to real that it's hard to discriminate. So what are deepfakes used for? They're used for misinformation, to share fake news, to share propaganda, but they're especially used in phishing attacks to impersonate. That is to take on the role of somebody in authority, somebody who's trusted, and to commit financial crimes. It's very common to use impersonations in cryptocurrency scams. A deepfake could be used to bypass biometrics. So biometrics are things like fingerprint recognition, voice recognition, face recognition. Well, if you can clone all these appearances realistically, it's possible that if your voice is used as your password, if your voice is how a system or a person recognizes you, well, that can be stolen and used against you. Another use case is sextortion. Sextortion is a problem that's happened to a lot of young people, especially where people in the past have shared intimate photos by cell phone, and then they get threatened that, you know, pay such and such money to such and such person or these photos will be reshared and you'll be publicly humiliated and so forth. Well, with deepfakes, you don't even need to get a real photo of someone. You can generate photos of people doing compromising or inappropriate things, and you can just generate them on demand. They can look realistic. So there's new ways that scammers and abusers can do extortion. When I was doing some research for this presentation, there was a whole bunch of fake videos that were portraying the pastor, T.D. Jakes, on YouTube. And these fakes were having him do, you know, embarrassing or incorrect things. Another use of this technology is a nudifier. A nudifier apps have tens of millions of users. They're easily accessible, even though they keep getting shut down by the major platforms. New versions of these apps keep popping up, especially on non-mainstream app stores. And what this software does is it takes a photo or a video of a person and it reprocesses it to basically strip away the clothing and non-consensually make somebody digitally undressed. So this can be used to embarrass or humiliate or extort people or revenge porn or whatever. It can cause harassment and emotional distress, public humiliation. So I'm mentioning these things not necessarily because maybe you personally might be attacked by it, but this can happen to our friends, our children, our communities. This is the world we're living in. Face swapping and puppeteering. So this is where basically artificial intelligence software is used to combine two different kinds of things together to produce a convincing hybrid digital product. So you can have an innocent person and photos of them and a porn video, and then the software will mesh it together and it will look like this innocent person is in the porn video. This happens to celebrities a lot. It could also potentially be used to on an ordinary everyday person to extort them or to humiliate them. Another thing that's really alarming is puppeteering software is software that will basically let one person speak or act. It'll take those behaviors and it'll make another person appear to be generating that speech or that action. So you can have a live cyber criminal who's basically wearing a digital skin, looking and sounding like whoever they want to look and sound like. So these things can be used for impersonations and fraud and phishing and abuse of all kinds. Deepfakes are booming. 60% of consumers report encountering a deepfake video in 2024. Now it's probably more like 89%. Most people see deepfakes. Frequently, they don't know that they're deepfakes. About a quarter of people online last year reported seeing a deepfake scam. As of the time this study was done, between 38% of people to 50% of people could not a deepfake if they saw it. That is, more often than not, people believe that deepfakes are real. And that's an old statistic. The technology is better, so people are tending to believe deepfakes at an even higher rate now. So AI can also produce deepfakes that are so good that AI detection can't detect them as deepfakes. There's an arms race between people producing them and people trying to identify them. Well, the defenders are not winning that arms race. So there's not really a good technical solution to say, this video is fake. Again, it's an arms race, so it keeps changing almost month by month or year by year. The prevalence in recent years of deepfakes was growing on the order of 10x year over year. That's probably not true anymore because the growth curves flatten out after a while. They become so prevalent that they may not be exponentially growing. But still, the prevalence has been booming, and they're a notably significant part of all fraud online now. And one source, the World Economic Forum, was saying that in Q1 of 2025, there was over $200 million of financial loss due to deepfakes, and we can expect that to increase. How do you defend against it? You want to, again, one of the principles that I'll keep mentioning is go to the known person and the real source. Go to what's reputable and trustworthy. If something comes to you in a digital format, it could be fake. Even a very realistic audio or visual image of someone you know can still be fake. So just be careful if there's something unexpected, untrustworthy about the message, if something is alarming or unusual, if somebody is asking for money or asking for access, let those things alert you. And one of the things is, as a parent, if you hear the voice of your child in distress, emotionally, you respond immediately in a powerful way, right? It hijacks your emotions. That's the exact kind of thing that an attacker wants to do. They want to harvest your excitement or your fear and weaponize it and use it to exploit you. And unfortunately, artificial intelligence technology makes that easier. So go to the actual person, go to the actual source, the actual website, and have a second way of verifying that something is true. For example, you can ask personal information. You can have a secret passcode that's known only to your family. And within your family, if one of you needs like emergency support or money or something, you know, maybe there's a passphrase that you've learned in a family meeting and you never share that online. And that way you can verify that grandma really is grandma. You can look for things that are like visual or audio inconsistencies or things that are out of place or jitter in the background, anything that makes the image or audio inauthentic. On the other hand, the technology keeps getting better and better and better that we just may not be able to tell something is fake by our own senses. So be skeptical of the content if it's provocative or shocking or urgent. There are some technical detection tools that can be used right now to find some deep fakes, but again, that's an arms race. So just focus on being literate and understanding digital threats and be aware, keep learning and questioning. Social media, about 70% of all scams come through information that's been scraped and pulled out of social media. There's something called OSINT, open source intelligence, and that is people scanning the public web and pulling in information. And as of this last year, most of the activity on the internet, over 50% of all activity on the internet is bots going out and pulling in information. There are now more bots active on the internet than there are humans, and they're doing most of the activity and transactions on the internet. So keep in mind, if something has been posted on the web, it's in the hands of many bots right now. And some of them are governments, some of them are companies, and some of them are attackers. So be careful about what you put online, and keep in mind anything that goes online can be used against you in the hands of a scammer who is running an AI agent to harvest this information and customize a personal attack and do that on a global scale. So I'll start to wrap this up. I've shared a lot of scary information, but at the same time, I want to emphasize that you can be safe online and you can use the amazing powers of this online world, but you need to follow best practices. That is, slow down. Don't be in a rush, either of fear or of excitement. Instead, be cautious and mindful and deliberate. If something comes to you, assume it's an attack. Sounds paranoid, but being in the security business and fighting the bad actors for decades, if you get an unsolicited message, if something is surprising, if it's not what you asked for, be careful. Think before you click on links or attachments or pop-ups. Think before you scan a QR code and then click on that. Is it the real QR code? Or did somebody paste something over it or modify it? How do you know? Generally, go straight to the source. Go to the authority, go to the actual website, find the real phone number of the actual company or human, and talk to them. Don't trust what comes to you as a middleman. Trust your gut. Listen to your feelings. If something is saying, this is unusual, this is strange, or this is not quite right, then hold off, get another opinion, verify it. You can ask for help. Work with your friends or family or trusted professionals and get a second opinion. Don't jump into something. Share the best defense tips that you have and educate other people. We need collaborative support to defend ourselves in a complex and changing world. If you don't understand something, if it's puzzling or confusing, well, don't accept it. Slow down. Give it that second or that third look and make sure it's real. Keep in mind, you have a big digital footprint out there. If you've done anything on the internet, then there's lots of ways of tracking you and building profiles about you. And attackers can exploit that and come back and they can try to look pretty realistic based on what's been harvested. So know that there's a digital footprint and that information about you can be used against you. Keep learning, keep growing, and gaining more information to protect yourself and others. If you've ever fallen prey, don't give in to the attackers. Don't pay ransoms. It just funds more attacks and just rewards them for their bad behavior. If you get attacked, change your passwords, update your email, verify your financial information, lock up your credits, and so forth. If you get attacked and you become a victim, make sure that you go back and you're actually following these best practices. Some of the things I'm recommending, and you know, because this keeps changing, find out the current recommendations from reputable sources. Contact your bank or financial institution right away. Notify the police if you've been victimized by a scam right away. It's good to create a paper trail that shows that you knew you were under attack at this moment. If you wait to do that, banks or other institutions may hold you liable for losses in the intervening time. So it's good to report and act on a potential risk as soon as possible. Consider getting professional help from reputable security services or professionals who help protect. But keep in mind that there's a lot of predators out there. If you search for something like clean my computer from malware or, you know, protect my identity, if you search for something online, there's a lot of scammers and fraudsters that will try to say, oh, we're going to rescue you. So make sure if you seek help that it's really from truly a reputable source. And there's a bunch of ways you can report scams. FTC.gov has a report fraud site. The I3C.gov is the FBI Internet Crime Complaint Center. And you can report fraud to them. The U.S. Postal Service has a mail fraud site, and you can report anything that's fraud that came through the mail, like fake QR codes or scams that have a physical paper trail. And I'll just mention in closing, again, this online world can be an exciting, powerful set of capabilities. We can connect with people, we can transact, we can share knowledge, we can grow wiser, we can travel the world with great freedom and flexibility. It's amazing what we can do with technology. Yet at the same time, there are bad actors out there. Most humans are decent and law-abiding and good most of the time, but there's a certain population of people who are out there to defraud and exploit and abuse. And these attackers have no conscience. They have no morals. They're often in other countries, not in the United States. So you can't go after them by law. They change their names and identities constantly, so they can't really be fingerprinted. Fraudsters are constantly evolving and churning, and they're predators. They're hunting for anyone who's vulnerable. They're hunting for anyone they can exploit. So when we venture into the online world, a degree of healthy paranoia is appropriate. Be a digital minimalist. Do things deliberately and thoughtfully. Keep in mind that anything you pull in and run on your machine, anything you download, is giving trust. And if you give trust to the wrong actor, then you have a risk of being compromised. So go out there and have fun, but also be safe, protect yourself and protect your loved ones. That's it.